Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour, episode number 37, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
Now, if you are new to the show, we come out every single Friday. Ravi and I go through the big stories that have been making the world of retro and tech throughout the week. And then, the second half of the show, that's where things really get exciting. We have on a special guest, someone who is really noteworthy in the history of video game development. And to be fair, I don't think they come much bigger than the guy we've got on this week.
Yeah, I spoke to him and I don't know how he agreed to come on this show. You know, it's Scott Miller, who was the founder of Apogee and 3D Realms. This is crazy.
You pulled out the big guns on this week's show,
yeah,
really, haven't
definitely.
You? I mean, you're looking at the games that he's been involved in. It pretty much reads like a who's list of those genre-defining games of like the late 80s and early 90s, even stuff like Wolfenstein 3D.
Yeah, I remember playing on my mum's PC and being blown away on that.
Well, you can even trace, you know, every game these days is an FPS. That was really the granddaddy of the first-person shooter genre, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, and then a lot of innovation and development that happened with Duke Nukem.
Yeah.
And, oh God, Duke Nukem Forever, dare I say.
Yeah, we are going to get the story of the painful development of Duke Nukem Forever and what you thought of the game when it eventually came out. And also, a really exciting new title that he's working on today, which is called Rad Rogers.
Yeah, if you've ever played Rough and Tumble on the Amiga or Jazz Jackrabbit or even Conkers, then this game's going to appeal to you.
It's a very cheeky return to those old school kind of platformers, isn't it?
So definitely, yeah. Watch the trailer. You might have to have some parental guidance on that.
Strictly 18 and over only. So Scott's going to be on the Retro Hour in around 20 minutes from now. Seriously, hang around for this one. I think this is one of our best interviews we've ever done.
Yeah,
really excited for this. Now, we're just going to say a huge thank you as well to the fantastic Christopher Folds, who's made a very generous donation to the Retro Hour this week.
Yeah, a reoccurring donation, Dan. I didn't know you could do that.
I didn't know you could do that either. But he's contributed to the show every month, which is awesome, Chris. Thank you so much.
Press submit wrong.
Yeah, just in case you have, we have alerted him to that now. But obviously, we have mentioned that we have got a little tip jar on the website, theretrohour.com. If you ever want to make a little donation, it all goes into the running costs of the show. And also, we're going to give something back this week as well.
Yeah, we're going to do our first giveaway, and this is thanks to Bitmap Brooks.
Now, this is Sam Dyer, who we had on a couple of months ago. He's a guy that does these really, really attractive visual compendium books.
Yeah, and, you know, these were we were calling them the coffee table kind of gaming books that you could have all these beautiful zoomed-in pixelated images. They have, what do they have done? They've got interviews and...
Oh, there's all sorts. Well, I mean, the book that we're giving away now, thank you so much to Sam and the team at Bitmap Books. They've actually given us two copies of the expanded edition. This is 476 pages. It's a hardback of the Commodore 64 Visual Compendium.
I must admit, I had to rip the seal off one and have a look inside myself.
One of them has been defiled, has it, Ravi? But these are brand new books and... they're presented so nicely as well. This is essentially a celebration of the visual style of the Commodore 64. Now, the cover, like, you know, a lot of games and demos and that kind of stuff in there. It's actually over 100 titles in this book. And they've got stuff like, you know, artwork throughout there by the likes of Oliver Frey, who was the artist on ZEP 64.
Oh, wow.
Back in the day, they've also got interviews with Commodore 64 artists, a look at the demo scene, and even there's a little section in there showing new games that have come out in recent years for the Commodore 64.
Thus, the expanded version.
Absolutely.
Yes. So we're going to run a comp. What are the rules, Dan?
Right, well, we do have two copies of the book to give away. So we thought, you know, we want this to appeal to the Commodore 64 heads. So if you know your Commodore 64 games, you should be able to identify the game that this song is taken from. What is this game? Wait for the drop. Not the hardest competition in history, is
no,
it?
No, I made a kind of little compilation that we were going to do, and Dan couldn't get any of them. So.
Yeah, I've been a Commodore 64 gamer for like 30 years. I couldn't get any of them, but yeah, everyone should know this game.
Yeah. So if you submit on the website on theretrohour.com, we're going to have a form on the front page. Mm-hmm. So you guys can submit your answer there.
Yeah, so all you got to do is nip onto our website, theretrohour.com. You'll see it right there on the front page, a little form. Fill your details in there. Give us the answer to the game that that song's taken from, and then we're going to run this, what, 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yeah, and then we will email you.
Yeah.
And also announce the winners on the show.
Absolutely. So we'll pick a winner at random from all the correct entries. Competition closes on midnight October 1st, so you've got a fortnight to do this. Everything you need to know and all the rules and online entry are on the website, theretrohour.com. Good luck. Right, then, before we get into Scott Miller, let's get into this week's news stories. Now, the N64's had quite a bit of exciting new hardware discovered recently.
Oh, yeah, with that DD drive, the PAL version and stuff.
Yeah, that Metal Jesus found. He did that video on we were talking about. Well, there's been another patent discovered. Now, this was a device called the Multimedia Expansion Device.
Oh, multimedia, that word that we used to love in the 90s.
It doesn't come much more 90s than multimedia, does it? No. But this is, it was just patents that Nintendo of America submitted, and someone on the forum has actually come across these on Assembler Games Forum, a guy called DS2, and he was looking through some like kind of long forgotten patent documents, and he found this. It's an expansion device that sits on the bottom of the N64, and these are kind of just like hand drawn pictures, so it doesn't really go into a lot of detail, but by the looks of the ports on here, it's quite a big expansion. It's about, you know, you're talking height-wise, it's about twice the height of the N64.
So you can stack it up.
Yeah. It looks like a stack system from the 90s, yeah. And on the back of it, they've kind of got some, like, detail of ports and stuff on there. So it looks like there's a modem built into it.
Oh, yeah, because I'm just seeing the little Ethernet port here, actually.
Yeah, whether it's Ethernet or modem, I'm not sure, but there is definitely some kind of connectivity there as well. And I'm looking at it, and it kind of looks a bit like, I mean, you look at the front of this, there's a few buttons on it. I mean, there might just be, like, network activity lights, but maybe there's even like a CD-ROM drive or something in there
as
well.
It's very strange as well. They seem to say it's got lots of coax going into it. So maybe there's some kind of TV signals being sent through there or some...
Yeah, well, that was kind of some of the speculation on Reddit where I first saw this. Some people saying maybe it was going to be in association with like a cable TV provider to do like kind of, you know, on-demand kind of content and stuff there too. But I mean, some people have been saying you could never download games on this thing because back then you had like, you know, dial-up. But N64 games, I mean, the average cart was about 64 megabytes. So you probably, it would take you about 3 hours to download a game, which isn't ridiculous. I mean, you look at like, you know, Xbox games now. I mean, I've updates that come down that are like 25 gigabytes, you know what I mean?
But also, if it had coax, maybe if they were sending it through the cable,
it
could be faster, you know?
I mean, obviously this device never came out, but I think it's kind of cool to look at, you know, ideas that Nintendo had for the N64, because it was really a platform that it never really reached its full potential in terms of add-ons. I mean, they came up with lots of ideas for it, but nothing ever seems to fly in the world of add-ons, really, for Nintendo products.
No, and even that RAM expansions were massive, weren't they? I think the Rumble Pack was the biggest add-on on there.
It was, yeah. I got one last year, actually, at Play. I think about £6 for it in the box. Japanese writing on it as well, so...
It doesn't fit properly, does it?
I've been trying to get it from Alice's side in the drawer for a year. But yeah, we'll link you up if you want to check out these patents. They are really interesting, actually. We'll stick those in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, being guys from Nottingham, we've talked about the National Video Game Arcade, which is, you know, kind of... It put Nottingham's gaming on the map and made the news headlines a couple of years ago when it started. But
yeah, because it was the first kind of video game centre in the UK. So this is, you know, for everybody.
And this was meant to bring, like, what, £2.5 million into Nottingham?
Yeah, but it looks like they didn't make a profit and they actually ran out of cash. Now, we had a few experiences going there.
Well, I've never been.
Dan's never been. He's tried, but he's never been.
Well, I know you've been there a few times. And, I mean, there's an article in our local paper, the Nottingham Post. It went into administration a couple of weeks ago. And it turns out they, you know, they went through all the money. It was £2.5 million to put this together as well. And they had like 50 staff working there as well. But I went along. I mean, I kind of work some weird hours. So often I have afternoons free, you know, maybe like 2 p.m. I might have a few hours free before I do other stuff.
Yeah, great times to go and play games and
Well, if I'm in town doing a bit of shopping, I've tried to get in here about three times. And, you know, I've made it into the foyer, got into reception and be like, how much is the ticket? And they're like, oh, well, you can't come in today. I'm like, all right, we're not open today, and there's some other event on. And you look at the opening times, and it seemed like they're only open, like, what, 2 days a week for, like, four hours or something.
And I think they put a lot of effort into half terms in it and turning it into kind of a place where you could, parents could come in with their kids, and then their kids could have a time. But they weren't engaging the older gamers. They weren't engaging the wider kind of gaming community. And hopefully now it's basically been bought out by this Nottingham Video Game Foundation, which seems to be made up from different companies around Nottingham and supporters of the NVA. So Sumo Digital, were one. Epic as well. There's Ian Livingstone, who is one of the big supporters.
Playground Games involved as well. Yeah.
So they're going to be taking over the NBA, and they're also going to be doing a festival, which is Game City, which is our annual gaming festival in Nottingham.
So that will be staying on, yeah.
So that will be staying on. Mm-hmm. So this is good news. We'll hope that the new management can kind of open it a bit more and get it a bit more engaging with the public and get some profit going.
Because I love the idea. It is a first of its kind in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, for someone like me who's loved video games all my life, to have not actually been able to get into this place in like 3 years.
It seems like, you know, this thing's a very new thing.
Yeah.
And maybe, you know, retro hasn't really been around for that long, retro gaming. Maybe it's a bit of a false start, and maybe they kind of need that to get taken it seriously.
Well, we wish the new team well, and it's good that it's been saved as well. I mean, you know, if you're ever up in Nottingham, as we've always said, drop us a little tweet or a message and we'll give you the tour of the gaming areas around town.
Yeah, I'll take you out for a beer and a game of Street Fighter.
Yeah, all on Ravi. Now, you love finding these kind of obscure stories, don't you? Last week you had the kid that found a mainframe and then got a job at Microsoft.
Yeah.
This week, a kid in India builds his own PC out of scrap e-waste.
Yeah, so e-waste is a massive thing, and particularly in developing countries, there's lots of kind of... I've been to India quite a lot, and they've had stuff like the way that people extract metal from old monitors and stuff. They just set fire to them and smash them with hammers. It's really bad.
And there's a load of metal in CRTs and stuff, I guess, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah. So all of this kind of old electronics is going there. Well, this guy... he's a 16-year-old kid, mm-hmm. and he's kind of wanted his own computer, and he's been surrounded by e-waste. So he's managed to make this tiny little kind of machine, but it actually looks really slick. If you look at it, it's like a 7-inch monitor,
yeah,
and it's built onto a small little cube. It actually looks like one of the old Commodore SX...
The Commodore 64 portable. It does actually. Yeah, it does resemble that. And he's running Windows XP on it, I can see here as well. And, you know, I couldn't have done anything like that when I was 16. I couldn't do it now. It's like, yeah, fair play to the guy. But I think it proves it kind of, if you want something badly enough, you know, you'll find a way to do it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this is a nice little innovative thing. And it also says that he kind of planned to drop out of school as mm-hmm. he had no interests. And then he suddenly got into computers and building stuff out of e-waste. And now he's global.
Well, fair play to the guy. I think that's awesome. So, if you want to read more about this story, we'll shove it in the show notes at theretrohour.com. You know, often we've kind of got, you know, a bit of, you could say, affection for these kind of obscure and failed video game systems, you know.
Yeah, you've got nearly all of them at your house. All
the ones that people consider crap I've got. You know? I've got a 3DO. I've got an Atari Jaguar. Yeah. Which is actually what this story's about, the Atari Jaguar. Now, the problem with the Jag is that obviously it wasn't really a big commercial success. And, you know, you always see it making those polls of, like, you know, the top 10 worst video game systems of all time. I have got a soft spot for the Jag. But the problem is collecting games for it is really hard because, you know, we've talked about the fact before that I know you like, you're trying to get an Amiga CD32 original collection built up.
Still hard.
That is hard, but yeah. Getting Jaguar stuff, I mean, there's like a Mario Kart clone on there called Atari Karts.
Okay.
And they go for about £600 for the original cartridges.
Wow.
You know. And because they're carts and...
And you can't play backups then because it's a cart as well, so you've got no chance of playing this game.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, at least on the Amiga CD32, you can burn yourself a CD-ROM.
And play it.
The problem is, you know, obviously Crix makes those EverDrive carts that are really cool. I've got one for the N64, for the Mega Drive, for the Super Nintendo N64. And people have asked him on his forum and that before, will you do one for the Jaguar? And his approach has always been kind of like, it's not popular enough to waste my time on. You know, I wouldn't sell enough, which is fair enough. But there is a guy on the Atari Age forum. His name is Saint, with a capital T on the end. And he did a Lynx SD card reader recently. And he's now said that he's now working on a Jaguar SD card, like an EverDrive.
Ah, nice. That will be good. And the Lynx as well. I think there are probably less numbers of Lynx around than there are.
You're probably right, yeah. Yeah. Especially working ones.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a guy that's obviously got a lot of love for stuff Atari. And he's seen this demand for this, and it's now a 7-page thread on Atari Age. And he's actually said that he's been working on this some time, like secretly, and it's pretty much ready.
But, Atari Age is definitely the place to talk about it because they've got a massive community there. So I'm sure he's probably getting pre-orders already.
Well, there was this thing, it's a skunk board, it's called, which was the only way to play backup games on the Jaguar. So what you did is, it had like a little bit of RAM on there, and you'd hook it up to a PC via a USB port.
And like flash it.
Yeah, so it'd just be one game at a time. And even those, you look at them on eBay, they go for about like 200 quid, because they're quite rare now. But, you know, this is something that the Jaguar community has been crying out for like about a decade now. So it's cool this guy's finally listened and been like, all right, you know, he's got it working and everything already. But he said the Lynx one's kind of taken up most of his time at the moment. So it might be another 6 to 12 months before it comes out commercially. But,
you know, it opens up potential for homebrew stuff to come out for the Jag as well.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Because there have been a few homebrew games, but they're all on the CD. And obviously the CD add-on is very rare.
Yeah. So, and emulators as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Jag emulators are not great either. You know, they're still not quite at the stage where they can, you know, replace true hardware. But you're right, I mean, you know, when these become available, and I think, you know, the price of his Lynx SD card reader is pretty affordable. So hopefully, you know, you'll be able to get this for like, you know, less than 100 euros.
Ace.
So, yeah, well, definitely worth keeping an eye on. Very exciting news for us.
Dan's going to get on that list, aren't you?
Look out for my video, no doubt. Yeah. Now, we've got a little announcement from friends of the show, the Lincolnshire Amiga Group.
Yeah, we're really disappointed because we wanted to go to this event. Yeah, and it's only an hour down the road, but we're both working. So this is the 10th anniversary of LAG, which is Lincolnshire Amiga Group. And this is the LAG Bash.
I love it.
Yeah. I've been to the Mag Bash, which is the Midlands Amiga Group, and that was really good years ago. But this one's going to be a massive event because they've got Trevor Dickinson, who is the guy from Aeon, so he's basically the current owner of the next generation Amiga stuff.
Well, he is Mr. Amiga, isn't he?
He's Mr. Amiga.
He's got the most impressive Amiga collection I've ever seen. He even walks around, he wears boing ball slippers.
And the tie and everything, yeah. And David Pleasance, the ex-CEO of Commodore UK.
XMD of Commodore MD, UK, wasn't he?
Yeah. Was it? Yeah.
Friend of the show, of course. We had him on, didn't we, a few months ago.
Oh, yeah. And there'll be other podcast people down there. So there'll be Aaron from RGDS.
Yeah.
And there'll be quite a few of our crew down there. So we're a bit annoyed that we're missing that one.
I know. It's coming up on Saturday, 1st of October. It happens just near Lincoln, a place called Welton by Lincoln. So it's not far from Lincoln Centre. I mean, you get trains and stuff like that as well. So, you know, I think just having an active Amiga group that have been going 10 years in 2016, I think is awesome. Because there's not many around anymore.
No. And I'm sure there will be a good piss-up at the pub afterwards.
Well, David Pleasance is there, you know there will. So we'll pop a link in the show notes at theretrohour.com if you want to sort your tickets and come along to that. Definitely worth going along and seeing the guys there. This will be a proper one for the Amiga nerds. Now, before we get into this week's interview with Scott Miller, speaking of Amigas and Ataris and that kind of thing, we've talked about the GoTech before.
Yeah, so the GoTech is a little drive that you can use, and you can load stuff off USB, and it will read it like a drive sector, and then you can change them about, and you kind of have to cut your case up. Well, you don't have to, but some people have done awful jobs fitting them into the case. Yeah.
So this is essentially a USB floppy disk drive emulator. So I'm sure you've seen these around before. You plug them into your old machine, like, you know, it can be an old DOS PC, can be a Commodore Amiga, it can be an Atari ST. You plug it into where the floppy drive used to go and the power in there as well. You know, size-wise, it's compatible with most drives. And instead of having a floppy disk insert slot, you put a USB key in the front with disk images. And as far as the original machine's concerned, you're loading floppy disks.
Yeah.
So it's a really handy way, rather than writing, you know, hundreds of old floppies and
running from room to room, which I do often.
Then getting read errors and all that on them. It's a really cool way of just having, you know, hundreds and hundreds of disk images. You get like a 4 gigabyte, you know, USB stick. You can have pretty much all your collection on there. So these have been around for a while now, but there is a guy on YouTube. His name is, I'm going to try and pronounce this, Gabor Sikos. Probably said that completely wrong. But he's posted a video of him controlling a GoTech remote controlled with an Android phone.
What? So, well, I don't get it. What? So he can control a GoTech?
I've got no idea quite how he's done this, because I guess there must be some kind of, must be Bluetooth or some kind of connectivity or some software
within
running
the GoTech that's connecting to the Android. So he's probably made a custom app.
He's got an Android phone open and he's got a keypad on there. And he can actually program the numbers of the tracks on the GoTech just using his phone, like, you know, wirelessly.
That's amazing. So you could basically have it inside the case. You wouldn't even need to stick a USB drive in there.
Yeah. Well, you know, you don't need to chop your cases up and all that, like you said a moment ago?
No, you could put it in a total different section of the case, like so you don't even see it.
Yeah,
you know?
Internal. Yeah. Yeah, so that is awesome. And actually, looking at the GoTech here, I think there is a little, like, you know, wireless receiver that he's put there in the side.
Ah,
so I think okay. The GoTech does have some, like, GPIO ports, so you can add stuff to it.
So maybe there'll be this kind of GoTech package that you could get, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, it looks really slick. I mean, even the graphics and everything of it, it looks professionally made. And at the moment, he said, you know, the only detail that's on the video is under testing. That's all he said about it, so...
Two more weeks.
Yeah, probably, yeah. So yeah. If you want to check this video out, that'll be in our show notes as well.
It seems to be done through Wi-Fi, I think...
Yeah, and the video, there is a receiver there, so it's a very, very slick solution, though, so hopefully be, you know, releasing that to everybody else, we can all get in on the action.
Nice.
So thank you so much for checking out episode number 37 of the Retro Hour. Don't forget, if you want to get involved in that competition to win those Commodore 64 Visual Compendium Extended Editions, you've got 2 weeks, identify that clip of the song that we played a bit earlier, which game's it from. The competition is on the front page of theretrohour.com. And we'll be out again next Friday. Now, into this week's special guest.
Oh God, it's Scott Miller, I can't believe it. And we talk about such great things as like Ken Silverman's engine and their connection with ID Software. Oh, it's just so
you've
good.
Got to hear the story of how he met John Romero as well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's coming up now. Here he is then for the next 45 minutes or so on the Retro Hour, Scott Miller, and we'll catch you next Friday.
Ciao.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is our pleasure to welcome this week's special guest. Welcome to the show, Scott Miller.
Yeah, no problem at all.
Really appreciate you joining us this week. So it would be quite nice to get your story right from the beginning. Let's just go all the way back. What was your first experience with a computer?
I was living in Australia, and our school got a computer. There was an elective class, and me and a bunch of friends took that class. And I think it was a Wang 2200. That the computer was. It had an attached keyboard, a built-in floppy drive. It had a printer that worked with it. It had a green screen that was something like, I'm going to say like 62 letters across and 12 or 15 lines down, just text, no graphics at all. Mm-hmm. But so I took this class, and I just didn't understand what computers were about. It was the only class in all my schooling years where I got a D, anything below a C.
Wow.
I just could not figure it out. And after that class was done and it was, you know, moving on into the next semester, friends of mine would come to me after school and say, hey, Scott, we're going to go hang around at the computer and, you know, after school. And I couldn't understand why they'd want to do that. I just saw a computer as a big calculator. And then they mentioned, well, we play games. And I was, what? You can play games? So I started taking interest, and they were typing in games from like magazines. Like there was magazines back in the day, like Creative Computing and a few other magazines that would like have basic programs that were maybe a page or 2 pages long, mm-hmm. and games like with titles like UFO or Wombat or Hunt the Wombat, just real simple games that you'd type in, you'd save it to your disk, and then you could play it. Anyway, I started typing in some of these games, and when you type in these things, you realize, well, okay, this is a print command, this is an input command, you know, this is a loop command, and it doesn't really take a whole lot of brain power to figure out, you know, the basic language, and you start tweaking with these values to see what they do, and pretty soon you start making up your own games, and that's what I started doing, and in fact, I got so addicted to it that this computer room had like a window, and I would like unlatch the window so I could sneak in at night.
Wow.
and stay there until like 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, just me with this green screen glowing on my face deep into the night, just, you know, type in my games. I'd write games on my, you know, my paper during the day at school, then I'd go type them in at night and get them working and so on. And I was doing this for several months before I was caught. And so when the caretaker at the school finally caught me, you know, the next day I had to go into school and I had to go see the principal and the computer teacher was there and he had my disks and he had printed out all my programs and stuff. And, you know, the principal was explaining to me, you know, Scott, this is something, you know, you broke a major rule here and this could be, you know, really bad for you. But then he said, but I have a deal to make with you. And he slid a key across his desk to in front of me. And he said, if you promise to help the computer teacher whenever he has a question, you can use that computer whenever you want. Because they had looked through all my programming and everything, and the computer teacher realized I was doing some pretty advanced stuff for the time, and I hadn't hurt anything, so they decided, you know, I was harmless.
You must have been the first kid in history ever to get busted sneaking into school.
Well, you know, it was that was some crazy times back then for me, at least. Because, yeah, I was such a, you know, I never got in trouble in school. So for me to do something like that, that just tells you, you know, how much the computer bug really had a hold of me.
Well, what languages were you initially programming in then?
I wasn't even aware there was more than one language back then. It was just basic. And it wasn't until – this all happened, by the way, when I lived in Australia. All my high school years, I lived in Australia. And when I came back to the United States, you know, I felt like I needed a computer. And so I got the Commodore 64. And then I eventually got the Amiga when it came out. And then eventually the IBM PC. And really, it was only when I started getting into these other computers, especially the Amiga, that I realized there were even other languages. You know, I knew there was other languages like COBOL and Fortran, but these were out-of-date business-only languages, and I didn't care about them. It wasn't really until I got the IBM PC that I started exploring other languages. And when the IBM PC was around in the early 80s, there was this company called Borland who was releasing these compilers that would do like Pascal and Modula and C, and it like so I switched over and started using Turbo Pascal, which was a super nice little integrated editor and compiler, and it was basically just as nice as using BASIC, because you know with BASIC you could type something in and then hit run and immediately see your results. Well, it was pretty much the same way with Turbo Pascal. That was how this company became so popular, is through this integration of editor and compiler, and it made it just so sweet and simple. And that's the language that really got my company, Apogee, kind of off the ground, because all my original games were written in Pascal. So, yeah.
It's quite interesting you mentioned the Commodore Amiga in there as well, because I know it was big in Australia and over here in Europe, but it wasn't really a big system in America, was it, in terms of, you know, commercially successful?
Well, it was either that or the Atari ST at the time. I think the Amiga may have come out first, so that was a factor. But I was a Commodore person also, and so I just wanted to stick with Commodore. And also the Commodore, from all the reviews I was reading back in the day before these computers came out, the Commodore was the more advanced one, the Amiga. You know, it had, you know, a true multi-threaded operating system, and it just could do a lot of amazing stuff. So, you know, I wanted to have the most advanced thing, so I went with that.
Well, when was the point that you kind of decided to found Apogee then and turn it into a proper games company?
It's kind of when my hobbies started making a lot of money. I realized, you know, I should really give this a full-time shot here and see how it works out. The deal was is that during the 80s, when I was making my games in Turbo Pascal, I had made a couple of adventure games. I had one called Beyond the Titanic. I had one called Supernova. And with these games, I had released the whole game onto the internet. When I say the internet, I mean like CompuServe and Genie and Delphi and Prodigy and American Online and all the bulletin board systems that existed back then. That was sort of the makeshift version of the internet back in the 80s. So I would release my games online and I would ask people to send me money if they liked them. And I hardly got any money at all. And so when I started working on my series of games called Kingdom Across, Caverns Across, Dungeons Across, what I did was I decided to only release a third. Like, I released them in episodes. So with Kingdom Across, I released that freely to the internet, online, through the, you know, through the shareware channels. At the end of Kingdom Across, I would say, you know, if you like this game, there's two more episodes. You just send me $15 and you'll get it all. And so I started making a lot of money that way. And I made even more Cross games, and it got to the point where for 2 years I was making about $150,000 a year just through people sending me checks in the mail. And it's not hard. I mean, it's not easy to get someone to send you a check. So I realized that if I actually had a real company and set up an 800 number and start taking credit cards, you know, this could be something even bigger. And then I realized that if I started to work with other authors who could even make better games than me, because I was by no means the best programmer going around, that, you know, using this model I had discovered that seemed to really be working, this shareware model of breaking things into episodes. You know, so I kind of really set my mind to finding other game developers that were out there And I found, I found several. I found like Todd Pogel, who went on to help me create Duke Nukem eventually. I found John Romero, who, and then I helped them form id Software, gave them their initial funding to form that company and make the game Commander Keen. And I found a bunch of other authors. And it's funny that all these people, when I first talked to them, they were extremely skeptical of the idea that you could make money by releasing your game on the, you know, freely on into shareware.
Those games that you were releasing as well, they were very, it was ANSI and ASCII kind of graphics, weren't they? They were very simple.
Originally, but that was like the limit of my ability. That's why I started working with other game developers who had, you know, more experience in graphics and so on. And so, you know, the Duke Nukem games, the original two side-scrollers that were released in the early 90s, those were EGA, they had parallax scrolling. And then id Software, when I worked with them, Commander Keen, John Carmack had developed a smooth scrolling technique that worked in EGA and then later VGA. That was just truly amazing. It matched anything that was happening on the consoles at the time. So, you know, it was really fortunate that I was able to work with them on the Commander Keen games and then later Wolfenstein.
Well, you found a rather interesting method of contacting John Romero by letter.
Sure, yeah. Well, the story there is that John Romero was employed at a company called Softdisk, and they were a company that released, they had a monthly subscription where you would get a disc full of, it had like maybe one or two games on it. It had a couple of utility programs, maybe an educational program. It was basically a magazine on disc designed for people who had PCs. And John was employed there, and he had been releasing a couple of games. And I had also had a couple of my games released on Softdisk. I had a free subscription because of that. And I was paying attention to, you know, the games that were released there. And I really liked the games that John Romero was making on there. And he had a game on there called Dangerous Dave.
Yep.
And a few others. And I was thinking, you know, this is exactly the perfect kind of game that you could break up into like three episodes. We could release the first one free on shareware and, you know, make a lot of money. And so I also knew that Softdisk was very sort of protective of the people that worked there. They didn't want anyone to get a job offer for someone else. So to get in touch with John, I couldn't just write him a letter saying, hey, John, I've got a cool deal here for you. Get in touch with me, because I knew that his mail would be screened. So I had to act like I was a fan. And so I sent him several fan letters, you know, where I said, hey, John, I found a bug in your program. If you get in touch with me, I'll tell you where it is and stuff. And really, I didn't find a bug in his program, but I thought he might be, you know, intrigued by that to see what I'd find. And weirdly, he never did contact me because of that. But he was pinning this so-called fan mail up on his wall, and he eventually noticed out of these two or three letters I'd sent him that it was all from the same address or the same phone number. And so that finally got him to write me back, and he wrote me this really angry letter saying, you know, what kind of crazy person am I, and all this kind of stuff. And it was a whole letter. I wish I would have kept it, but it was this whole letter. And then at the very end, it had his phone number. And I was like, okay. So I called him up, and when I got him on the phone, I said, John, here's the real reason I was writing those letters. And I got him to calm down right away, and I explained to him, and he goes, okay. So he finally got it. And then he said that just by total coincidence, they had very, very recently, like within a week or two, had created this smooth scrolling engine, and they had a demonstration of a Mario game. And so he sent me that disc. I was totally blown away. I said, look, you know, this would just do a killing as a shareware game. Like I said, they still didn't believe that you could make money in shareware. And so they said, you know, they would like to do a game, but they would require some money up front just to cover their time, because they didn't really feel like it would do well. And I said, how much do you want? And I remember John thinking for a little bit, and he said, well, can you do $4,000? And I said, the check will be written like before I'm done with this call. And so I sent him the check. They sent me the design of the game, which was this one pager about Commander Keen. 6 months later, the game was done, and it did super well in shareware. In fact, it, you know, within the first 2 months, the guys at id Software, before they were even, I mean, they were still employed at Softdisk, they decided that they were going to quit Softdisk and you know, make their company a full-time effort also and make more Commander Keen games, and, you know, the rest is history.
Well, I remember at the time, obviously, you know, when Commander Keen came out, it was a groundbreaking game. Nobody thought that you could do, like, a really smooth side-scrolling platformer quite like that on the PC, did they? Must have been quite a technical achievement.
Yeah, it was. And I think John Carmack's talked about, you know, apparently he was doing some sort of trick within the graphic card itself to get that smooth scrolling technique. And I understand the technique. It's not that hard once you know it. It's too much to go into detail here, but I mean, it was just really, really clever programming. And that's kind of what John's whole career is about, you know, is discovering clever little hacks and tricks to really get something out of your PC that no one else thought was possible.
Well, Duke Nukem was your very kind of cartoony side-scroller, and I'd say it was a bit more, it felt more hardcore than Commander Keen, but also a bit more childish.
Yeah, I mean, the original Duke Nukem, that was actually the third game that I had worked on with Todd Ripogl. His first two games, no one's going to ever know about. They weren't that good. And so he was inspired by, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies at the time. And so he sent me this demo that kind of had this guy jumping around, and he had called the game, you know, he was calling this demo Heavy Metal. And I was like, you know, for one, Todd, there's already a movie out there with that name. I said, you know, why don't we come up with a character name, and you know, kind of like what we did with Commander Keen, and you can kind of focus on the character. And so, you know, we thought for a little while, and I remember I came up with the name Duke. I always thought that was a good, strong name. And then about a week later, he came up with the second name, which was Nukem. So that's how the name came about. We just kind of, you know, designed the game on the fly back then. You know, no one ever really thought too much ahead about the design. You know, like Commander Keen, that was just like a paragraph. I mean, that's all there was to the concept, was just one paragraph. You know, with Duke Nukem, we just made these things up as we went. You know, we knew we wanted it to be sort of a futuristic theme and that kind of thing. And nothing was really coherent about the design at all in that game. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of silly stuff in there, like the Energizer bunnies and stuff like that. So, but like I said, it was just all made up by the seat of our pants as we were going. There was no design document that we were following.
Obviously, after kind of this 2D era, I mean, I still remember vividly seeing the first Wolfenstein 3D game in a shop running on a PC and being blown away. It was kind of the first time I'd seen a first-person shooter. What was your reaction when you first saw that engine then?
Well, I first saw the engine when I saw a game called, it was a tank game that they had done for Softdisk. And there was no texturing to it at all. The polygons were just all flat-shaded. You know, the id guys were also still working on Commander Keen game stuff, but I said, you know, there's got to be a way we can get this kind of game into shareware. I think, you know, I said, I think it'll be, you know, even a way bigger blockbuster than Commander Keen games. They were still kind of obligated, the software guys, they were obligated to do several more games with Softdisk under the termination agreement that they had signed with Softdisk. They had this idea to do a Wolfenstein game. And they said, you know, this is the final game that we need to do with Softdisk. And I said, look, this game is way too good to give to Softdisk. And I said, why don't you let me and my partner, George, make a game for Softdisk that, you know, you could release under your name. You could pretend like you guys made it. And we'll take Wolfenstein and put that in the share market. So they agreed to it. And so instead of getting Wolfenstein, Softdisk got a little side-scrolling game called Aquaventure that wasn't all that great, but it fulfilled the agreement that its software had with Softdisk. And in return, Apogee, my company, got to release Wolfenstein into the world of shareware, and, you know, it just exploded.
I mean, it's crazy to think that, you know, even now, like 25 years later, you can kind of trace, you know, the first-person shooters are still the biggest genre in the world. And I know there were a few before that, but that was really the game that started that entire genre. I mean, at the time, did you realize it was something really special?
Yeah, I strongly suspected it would be. Now, you get, also, there's some more to the story. I mean, like, for instance, the first iterations of Wolfenstein weren't nearly as cool or promising as the final game turned out to be. Because the original game, the design had a lot of, like, tactical elements that really slowed it down. For instance, you could sneak up behind an enemy, kill him, and then search his body for stuff, and then you could hide his body, because if you left his body out in another patrolling guard saw the body, it would bring in a bunch of other guards down on you and stuff. And so there was all this sort of searching and moving bodies around and hiding them, and it really slowed things down. I remember when I was playing these early versions of the game, I was sending id Software back notes saying that I don't think this stuff fit with the game. You know, I know that for my part, I tried to help get the game more to just being pure action, which is what it ended up being. And at some point, they agreed, and all that sort of strategic stuff was removed from the game. And in my opinion, it made for a much better game.
Well, after this, there was a small engine from a guy called Ken Silverman, who was a young man who'd contacted you, and it was Ken's Labyrinth. How did you help Ken develop his engine?
Well, he had a game engine that kind of was similar to the Wolfenstein engine. So yeah, he had released a little demo game out there called Ken's Labyrinth. And I forgot how I got in touch with him or if he got in touch with me, but you know, we started talking. You know, I knew at that time that id Software was going to go off and do their next big game, Doom, and they were going to self-publish it. So, you know, in my opinion, you know, actually, we needed our own engine guy, like a Carmack, to help us make games. So Ken Silverman, you know, he was young at the time. I think he was maybe 17 or 18, but, you know, you could tell that he was super smart. I remember like a year or two later, John Carmack even complimenting Ken by saying that, you know, as far as John was concerned, Ken was the next best 3D coder out there. You know, Ken was a really smart guy. And, you know, we started working with him and, you know, we let him know that it was moving up to their next engine. It was going to be, you know, it wasn't going to be just a 90 degree sort of an engine. It was going to be, you know, there was going to be height to it. You can go up and down. You could, the walls could be at any angle. There was going to be shadowing. And so Ken thought, well, if, you know, if John can do it, then he could do it too. And so he said, you know, Ken set about to make us a competing engine. That's when we started developing Duke 3D.
Well, it's great because that engine kind of developed so much, adding like fake looking up and down, translucency, and, you know, stack sectors and all of this stuff. And it really helped kind of create a new game. And that obviously led to Duke Nukem 3D.
Right. Carmack's approach has always been, you know, super lean and super mean with his engines. And it's an approach that really worked for them. And it's an approach that really works when you're the first one to the party, and which they were with Duke. When you're second to the party, you need to have some more bells and whistles. And that's why we added a lot of stuff to the Duke 3D version of the engine that wasn't in, you know, Carmack's engine. You know, we had to have all that other stuff in there too, so that we weren't just like a full-on clone of their game. We had to have extras and more of this, and, you know, looking up and down and the stack sectors, like you said. You know, these were all things that we knew we needed in the game to take it to the next level.
Well, around this time, obviously, you know, Doom was massively popular as well. I mean, did you keep in touch with John Romero around this time at all? Was there any kind of conversations had?
You know, it really kind of fell off once they started working on Doom. I remember going over to their offices a couple of times to see what they were working on. And, you know, John would give me a really good sort of preview of the game, you know, as it stood at the time. And, you know, it was always super impressive. Also around this time, in 1994, Apogee started working with a newly formed company called Parallax Software. And these are the guys that went on to develop the game Descent, which is kind of set in, it was like a full 3D style game, 6 degree of freedoms, where you're flying these little spaceships through these corridors, shooting at other spaceships and so on. So this was a game that was going to be our first full 3D game. The two main guys from Parallax, Mike Kulos and Matt Toshlog. Anyway, these guys had come down to Dallas, and I arranged a meeting to go over to see the id Software offices. And so we went over there for a couple hours, and I remember we all talked to, you know, both, you know, John Romero and John Carmack. And it's amazing how forthcoming John Carmack always is with all of his, like, technical innovations with his games and stuff. It just seems like he'll just tell you whatever you want to know. And so Matt and Mike, you know, we all learned a lot about what they were working on over there at the time. And I'm sure it really helped out Matt and Mike in terms of their Descent engine. Anyway, we never ended up publishing Descent because we sold the rights to Interplay, and they took it to the retail market. But part of this is, you know, it's amazing how back in those days, sort of like the community was very open. Like, we would share information with anyone. I know that id Software would. And it was just, it was just all part of the share receive back in those days. You know, it was all very open. And that's why even like the whole modding community merged, because it was always about, you know, set the information free, set the code free, let people enjoy it like they want.
Not signing NDAs all the time. And
exactly.
And I suppose that was a completely opposite to the consoles, where it was a closed world.
True, but I wonder if it was even possible that, you know, on the consoles to do anything differently. I mean, on the PC, it was, you know, easy. I, like, when we released Duke Nukem 3D, you know, I think we released the editor as part of the package, and we had developed a scripting system to allow people to modify things, because it was very obvious to us, you want to turn your fan base into, you know, into a development team of sorts. And it just keeps the project alive. It just keeps the game alive if people can modify it and extend it and just use it really as a toy.
Well, it's crazy because even with Ken's engine at the moment, people can still modify it and have 24-bit graphics and everything on there.
It truly is amazing. It truly is. 20 years later.
Well, with Duke Nukem, it was such a change from the original platformer and had some really innovative stuff, like hearing the guy's voice behind the shooting and the kind of tongue-in-cheek themes as well that they had in there. Did you enjoy creating that?
Yeah, it was a ton of fun. It was really, I mean, a lot of that stuff happened just because, you know, the specs of the PC kept improving and the sound cards kept improving, and that allowed us to add voice and better music and so on. So we were just taking advantage of the fact that, you know, technology kept improving. You know, the 90s was such a wild ride because it seems like every year or two, the specs had doubled. It just opened up a whole new world of things you could do. So, you know, from really the beginning of that that decade, you know, we went from Wolfenstein in 1992 to, you know, Half-Life at the end of the decade. Mm. You know, with physics gameplay and all kinds of cool things. So it just all happened so fast that decade.
Well, Ravi mentioned that about Duke Nukem's voice, and I think, you know, today that's kind of as iconic as the rest of the character as well, and it's really one of the things that everyone really remembers about, you know, Duke Nukem 3D. Who was involved in the creation of the voice then, and how did the ideas come about Duke's voice?
The voice actually didn't enter the game until the final probably 5 to 6 months of the game. It was never really planned from the beginning for Duke to say anything. When the voice was first, you know, the idea of using the voice was first came up, the idea was for just to, like, use his voice to, like, select the different skill level. Like, you know, we had 4 or 5 different skill levels, and if you selected one, we were going to have Duke actually read it off. I think we were going to have him say something like, when you start the game, like, you know, let's rock. So these were all uses of the voice outside the actual gameplay. When we started hearing Duke's voice, you know, everyone was like, wow, I really like this. Is there a way to put this in the game too? And so I know we did a couple of test, you know, lines of, you know, Duke saying stuff in the game, just like if he killed someone, he might say something. It turns out that was really fun. And so then we started writing lines for, like, specific events, you know, like one-timers and stuff. So it all kind of happened really sort of last minute, and I think we got maybe about 100 lines in the game, and I know we were adding lines until the last second because it's like the more we added, the more we liked it. So it was really kind of just a happy, fluky thing that led to him having that voice. But once we heard his voice in the game, we knew we were onto something, and we wanted to really add to it. You know, it just added so much personality. That's where so much of Duke's personality comes from, of course, is the way he talks and so on. And, you know, everyone on the team was contributing lines, you know, coming up with stuff. So it just came from everywhere. But it's one of those things that once it started, it just snowballed.
I imagine around that time, that probably sold a lot of PC sound cards as well.
Right. And another thing is that before we added the voice to Duke, there was always sort of the mindset with these games that the character on the screen should reflect you, the player. And so there was always a bit of pushback, you know, should we make that character, it's, you know, someone else that's not really you. And so when we started giving Duke his voice within the game, there were some people who still thought, this isn't right. I don't feel like I'm playing me anymore. I think enough of us realized that well, you may not be playing you, but you're playing someone that you might aspire to be. And that's just as important.
But it had all the you know, the really cheeky elements in there as well, stuff like, you know, strippers, even toilets in the game too. I mean, was it kind of a conscious effort to make Duke like the ultimate macho man at this stage?
Kind of in an over the top way, and we didn't really ever want anyone to take it too seriously. It was more played for humor. Duke never purposely says anything funny, but what he says is kind of funny because it's almost too over the top to be true. So, yeah, I mean, we went a lot for humor. You know, it was kind of like, you know, the one-liners that you'd hear Arnold Schwarzenegger say, you know, I'll be back and stuff like that. You know, so you kind of wanted to give Duke that same sort of fun personality.
Now, Duke was a massive game, very popular everywhere, and it still stuck to that shareware model as well. So was that working out with Duke?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were still, you know, every game we released, even up until the first Max Payne, which came out, I think, in late 2001, we still had a shareware version of that, too. It was a model that can still totally work. Basically, what a lot of publishers did, because they saw the success that we were having, they basically started releasing demos. That was kind of their version of shareware. They would release, you know, a one or two level a demo of their game.
It's still like that today, I guess, isn't it? With like Xbox Live and PSN, you download like, you know, a short like one level demo, I suppose. It's essentially shareware, isn't it? Just online.
It's really the same concept. Now we were releasing like a whole one third of our game back in the day, except for when it came to Max Payne, we decided to only release about maybe 15% of the game as shareware. So it really became more like a demo when we did it that way. But it still allowed people to order the game directly from us. And we sold, you know, tens of thousands of copies directly with Max Payne. And with Duke 3D, we probably sold 100,000 copies directly to consumers on top of, you know, the millions that were sold in stores.
Well, you mentioned Max Payne there, and obviously, you know, that was such an atmospheric and intense game. How did the story of Max Payne come about then?
Well, the team was Remedy Entertainment. They were located in Finland, and they had contacted us. They wanted us to take a look at their game that was called High Speed, which was a little top-down 3D racing game. And I really liked the game, and I really liked the team. And so we ended up making a deal. We renamed the game to Death Rally and added some fun elements to it. And you know, the game went out there, and it actually did really, really, really well. And so Remedy, you know, wanted to do you know, more games with us. And so after about 3 months, after Death Rally was released, they visited me in Dallas, and they had three game pitches. One was a bit like Homeworld. One was a big, full 3D racing game. And one was a top-down game where you played a detective and you solved, you know, these crime puzzles. I told them I didn't really like the space game. I felt like that was too big of a project. I didn't like racing at all. We'd already done that. But I did like this game that they were calling Dark Justice. And they wanted to do all three games. And I remember sitting down and saying, look, that's going to be a big mistake. You're a growing company. You should really just focus on one game. And I think it should be this Dark Justice game. But I think that we should take a look at this design here and do something different. And so I suggested them, you know, let's do a full 3D game. Let's create this character. Let's give this character this great backstory. And this meeting took place like in late 1996. And I remember saying, you know, if we develop this right and make such a compelling character, there's a good chance that a film will be made out of this. And sure enough, eventually there was one. So they kind of really bought into my ideas and my suggestions. And they went back to their offices and they started working on a full 3D game and developing this character. And, you know, we spent months and months and months trying to come with just the right name for the character. And, you know, I remember suggesting Max early on, but we could never come up with a good last name. And we'd actually trademarked the name Max Heat. That was like the best we could come up with. But I knew it just didn't feel right as a name. And someone from Remedy sent this big list of about 30 names of last names as suggestions. I remember reading through it, and I came across Payne, P-A-Y-N. It was like, my God, that's the perfect last name. And so we abandoned the Max Heat trademark. We got the Max Payne trademark. And, you know, that became the name. And, that project took about 3 or 4 years to make. Another huge hit.
Well, some of the innovations, like bullet time that was seen in there just after The Matrix, and some kind of atmospheric stuff like the blood maze, I remember that. They were really interesting, and you wouldn't usually expect them in that kind of game.
I'm almost sad that The Matrix came out when it did, because we had all that stuff in there before any of us saw The Matrix. I'd actually come up with the name Bullet Time before the movie came out. The effect came about because I was in Finland. I would visit them every once in a while to work on the project over there. And I remember being over there, and they were showing me these cool death animations to where when Max would shoot a guy, the game would switch into the slow motion mode, and the guy would fly backwards in slow motion, hit a wall, crumple down, ragdoll physics. That looked really cool. And I was so blown away by this. I was like, there's got to be a way we can use this as actual gameplay. I remember suggesting, what if Max had this power? It felt kind of odd seeing it because it felt like giving Max a superpower, but I was like, we just got to go with it, and we'll just explain it as, he has just these ultra quick reaction, reflexes and so on. And so they added it to the game to where Max could activate the slow motion stuff. It just worked out like a miracle. It was just the thing that made the game, from good to completely awesome. And this was probably about a year and a half into development. It wasn't an idea that was there at the beginning at all. It was just another one of these amazing, happy discoveries that can happen along the way.
Well, obviously around this time, and while all this was going on, Duke Nukem Forever started development, which of course did become kind of a legend in the video game industry over the next decade or so. What's the story with that from your perspective then?
What's the story with Duke Forever? Well, it ends up being a sad story. let's see. Well, that was a project that was primarily run by my partner, George. And the projects I focused on were Max Payne and then later, Max Payne 2 and then Prey and some other projects that we worked on the side. I just think that with Duke Forever, I think that I think my partner George was under such pressure to really sort of top what we had done with Duke 3D. And then it became a matter of also topping what other games were doing out there. As time went on, better and better games were released by their companies. And, I think the feeling was, whatever we do with Duke 3D, it has to be the best thing ever. And other companies were making, progress on their engines and doing amazing things. And every time something really innovative came out from another company, there was a lot of pressure to include whatever that was into Duke Forever. And it just ended up being, development. It was a development money pit. And it really until about the last 2 years that the company, up until like between I think around 2006 and 2008 is when the company sort of released all the employees at 2008. But about the 2 years up until the 2008, I think we were finally getting on back on track. We had hired a really good producer, Brian Hook, who used to work at id Software and now he works at Oculus. He came in as the producer and really kind of gave the team the exact right kind of project management. George's area was always sort of the creative side of things, and we needed someone who was really hardcore on project management, and that's what Brian Hook was giving us. So I really think that if the company could have stayed together another year or two, that we would have had a really, really strong release. But Take-Two pulled its funding from us, and so the game just, we basically had to do a deal with Gearbox to finish it.
So I remember reading, magazines and stuff throughout the 2000s, and it would seem like, that there'd always be a news release and they'd show some new screenshots, and it was like a complete reboot of the game. I mean, how many times was it? Was it started from scratch several times then?
Yeah, I don't think it was ever really started from scratch, but, there was, we did one engine change very early on. We went from its Quake engine to the Unreal engine. And then we kind of basically just rebuilt the Unreal Engine over the years. Yeah, every couple of years it had a pretty massive technology upgrade to it, so it would look very different. I mean, that was the problem. You know, it was, you know, if we would have just locked down the engine early on and just built ourselves a game, it would have been fine. But I think George wanted to have a game that also had the best engine on the market too when it was released.
I also think it would be, it was quite hard to actually satisfy everybody after that time period, you know, waiting sure. so long.
Right. I mean, after it became like 5 and 6 years and we were winning all the Vaporware awards, it almost became like this vicious cycle of, you know, now we really have to release something great or else people are going to be disappointed. So it just became an impossible task, I think. You know, I don't think that, I mean, we would have really had to release something of the utmost highest quality, I think, to get, you know, high praise, because I think just the fact that we took so long to make the game was going to really hurt us.
And what did you think of the completed product then?
Honestly, not much. Not much. Yeah, we sold the rights to Gearbox, and we thought that the game would be, I guess, much more improved over the state of the game when Gearbox took it over. That was a bit disappointing that it was basically the same game that we handed to them. I know that there was a small team called Triptych who was former 3D Realms employees who kind of helped stitch the game together and get it to where it could be something that could be released. But, you know, they were a small team, and I think it was just too much for them to handle. And, you know, they did a really good job given the circumstances, but I was really expecting that Gearbox would add 10 or 20 of their own people to the project and just really kind of make it a true AAA release. And I don't think that happened.
How much of that kind of code from the 2000s and the engines and stuff still exists then? Because it will be quite interesting to see that stuff. Is it still around somewhere?
You mean, is it on, like, my hard drive or something?
Yeah.
I think that there might be a couple of hard drives in storage somewhere. I don't know. It's not something I've seen in years. But, I mean, it might be somewhere. I'm not really much of a nostalgia guy. I don't really go back and save a lot of this stuff. I probably should, but I don't. But it might be somewhere on a hard drive I have in storage or George has on storage. Or, you know, I'm sure some of the coders who worked on the project, I'm sure they probably have, you know, copies of it stored somewhere. So I'm sure something exists. I doubt if it'll ever be released, though.
Well, reaching full circle as well, you've started a new Kickstarter, and this is Rad Rogers, which is a return to the old school style Apogee platformer. And I checked out a video of it, and we used to play a game on the Amiga called Rough and Tumble, and it came out really late in the Amiga's life, and it was a really good game, and this game looks like it's been influenced by it very strongly.
Right. This is more of an Interceptor project. 3D Realms is involved more as a consultant and, you know, an advisor on the project. But it's an Interceptor game. You know, these are the guys that did the Rise of the Tribe reboot, which was really, really well done. The leader of Interceptor, his name is Fred Schreiber. He was a big fan of Rough and Tumble and a bunch of these other games. And so his idea was to sort of, you know, make a game that reflected sort of the old school sort of play style and, you know, just go back to the old school ways of retro shooters. And, you know, I've played a lot of Red Rogers, and it really feels like an old school shooter in lots of ways, but it's done, you know, in a totally modern engine, Unreal Engine 4. It's got lots of fun bells and whistles to it. It's got great voice acting. You know, John St. John, the voice actor for Duke, he plays Dusty, which is the sort of the console come to life that's in the game. Lisa Minnelli, she also had some voice work in the original Duke 3D, and she has a few cameos in this game. She's like the voice of that tree that talks. So a lot of people that we worked with back in the 90s are, you know, play a role in this game. So it's sort of an old school retro shooter. I think it's a really fun game.
It looks like it's got lots of elements of, you know, the old shooter in it. It's like a good platformer, but also from the trailers, some of the personalities of the characters in there remind me a lot of Duke Nukem and the kind of cheekiness and rudeness in it, to be honest.
Right, sure, yeah. And that's going to be something that parents can toggle off if they want to. But, you know, we feel like this is an old school shooter. There's going to be a lot of people in their late 20s, 30s, 40s, maybe in their 50s who will give this a try, sort of take them back on a nostalgic road trip. And, you know, for these people, having this kind of humor is probably okay. You know, this game's got a few cool little innovations, too, like to really help out with the humor. Dusty, his character, is fully aware that he's in a video game. He's fully aware of other video games in existence. And so he breaks the fourth wall a lot by, you know, referencing other video games, you know, in clever little ways and stuff. And another way we break the fourth wall is that this game has a game within a game, to where you'll come across areas of the game where sort of the universe, or we call it the pixelverse, sort of broken down, and only Dusty can go in there and sort of like behind the matrix into the code and sort of fix things. And you don't really see that in the demos or the trailers we're releasing yet, but that's another really cool part of the game.
So when can we expect the game out then?
I think we're shooting for late this year. I don't know if there's a date yet. Some of it's going to depend on this Kickstarter. You know, we hope it funds. If it doesn't, we'll have to scramble to get investment somewhere else. But, you know, right now it's tracking to fund pretty easily. But, yeah, the goal is this year for sure.
Well, we'll put a link in our show notes as well if people want to follow the Kickstarter. There is still a bit of time left on that, 20 days at the time of recording. So we look forward to playing the game, though. We're really excited.
Yeah, definitely. I think you'll enjoy it.
Absolutely. Well, Scott, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this week. It's been so interesting.
Thank you, Ravi. Thank you, Dan. Have a great time. Anytime.